Hi, this is Bernie Wides, the naturalist, on the air at the Heritage Radio Network. And we're broadcasting from Bushwick, downtown Bushwick, on a beautiful sunny day. And this is part two of our talk on bees, which we started last week. And this week, we're going to continue. So just a quick wrap-up from the last week's talk. We spoke about bees and how they swarm when the queen gets old and they have to go looking for to set up a new hive. And we're going to start now with part two of bees, and we're going to talk about introduce my guest today is Carol Butler, whose new book on why bees buzz has just come out and will be in your local bookstores shortly. And it's a terrific book. It's a question and answer format, and it's great for families because the kids always ask questions. They say why and how and all that, and you could look it up in the bee book, and it tells you why and how and all that stuff. And it's a great addition to your home library. And
Thank you very much.
So, Carol Butler, let's talk about honey and the royal jelly and that stuff to start off with.
Okay. I thought maybe we should, in fairness, since the title of the book is Why Do Bees Buzz? Maybe we should answer that
question.
That's
a good idea. Why do bees buzz?
Right. So the buzzing is the result of the vibration of their bodies and their wing muscles. They vibrate these things in different ways, and the vibrations resonate through the hive. So sometimes the buzzing is just the sound of the bees at work, and sometimes they use buzzing and other noises to guide their nest mates. They use buzzing, they call it piping behavior, it's a type of noise making and vibration when they're about to swarm. They communicate with buzzing as well. They cool the hive and help dehydrate the honey by beating their wings, which also makes a buzzing sound.
Okay.
They buzz less in hot water because, in hot weather.
Hot weather, right.
Because they beat their wings more slowly to reduce the risk of overheating themselves. So
right,
they have
sure.
to be careful.
Okay.
And the queen honeybee actually announces a threat to the nest by making quacking noises.
Quacking?
This is
like
what
a duck?
I've read. They also say that the queen toots. This I would like to hear. This I have never heard.
Tooting and quacking.
Right. These things are called queen piping. And they're produced by rapid contractions of the bee's thoracic muscles, and they occur without wing movement,
mm-hmm.
And also are reflected and vibrate and reflected by the beeswax in
yeah.
the hive.
So that's interesting because bees, being invertebrates, they can't really control their temperature as we can.
Endothermic,
that means we sweat, we perspire, and we can control our internal temperatures. But insects have to find other ways to do it. So I imagine one of the strategies is beating their wings, maybe.
Right.
Would maybe, I don't know if that would help cool them down, but it does help with the production of the honey. And
They fan the honey to get the moisture out of it.
So it evaporates, it right.
It condenses. They have a whole procedure to try to maintain the temperature in the hive,
right.
which involves the beating of the wings. In the cold weather, they gather in sort of a ball, and they take turns being on the outside of the ball and the inside where it's warmer to just try to stay alive.
Right,
and they
right.
use up the food stores that are in the colony that they have accumulated, and hopefully there's enough, or if a beekeeper is taking care of them. Erica, take note. In the winter, the beekeepers add honey if it looks like the stores are low, they will have enough to get through the winter.
Right, that's
because there are no flowers to forage from.
Right, so the whole purpose of the honey is to keep the bees alive through the winter.
Right, right.
And it's just a byproduct that we have learned to collect the honey and use it.
Right,
and that's why people raise bees to get the honey.
Right,
but you have to keep enough. For the bees to make it through the winter at this latitude, at least.
Right.
Down in Florida, where the flowers bloom all the time.
Right.
Then you don't have to do that.
Right, and so, in the winter, yeah. the colony can die if there isn't enough honey left because it's been a bad season. It's been a cool summer, and they haven't accumulated enough. They just have no way to survive until spring, when the flowers start to bloom again.
Yeah. Okay, so the,
there's a nice segue. You know, I think that's a beehive out there.
It could be one.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. That's right. I just noticed that.
We're looking out the window from the studio.
Maybe it's one of Brian's beehives.
Yes, of course, they have beehives here.
Oh, good.
Okay, so we were going to talk about honey.
Right.
Honey is the sweet. It's a viscous fluid that the honeybees produce. Probably you have a jar of honey in the kitchen or in the house somewhere. I know I have one. I don't use it too often, but it's delicious. And as we said before in the earlier show, it was very important when it was the primary sweetener and there were no refined sugars. Honey pulls moisture out of the air so that when you bake with honey, the product tends to stay moist. This also creates honey also because of this hygroscopic property creates an unfavorable environment for bacteria and mold because it actually dehydrates them. It draws water from inside their cells, causing them to die of dehydration. Mm. Honey is also acidic, and that further prevents spoilage and inhibits germs. So it's very good for a lot of things. People, beekeepers certainly will put a little honey on a wound because of this acidic quality that it kills germs and use it to try to help heal.
Yeah, and it lasts forever almost if you have it in a jar or container.
Right.
Right? The honey lasts a long time. It may harden, but I think I remember what you can do is you can just heat it up, the honey, and it will become a liquid again. So it's a very good thing to have in your kitchen and at home. And a lot of people use it when they have sore throats.
Right. And the Egyptians used it.
It was
found in the tombs. They have found equipment that looks like it was used for collecting honey. And there's a wonderful woman named Eve Crane who has collected all kinds of rock of art, of drawings from caves of people collecting honey, and she's dated some of them. It's really interesting stuff.
Yeah, and I mentioned in the first show that the Mayans or the Incas, you know, the folks who built those pyramids in Mexico, there's one devoted to the honeybee, which has these stone carvings of honeybees because the bees were really important to that civilization also. It was probably one of the few sweeteners that they had to use.
Let me just say quickly, one of the questions we have in the book, why are there so many different kinds of honey? And the flavor and color of honey depends on which flowers the bees have been using as a nectar source. And if you have a beehive, the flowers bloom in different cycles. And so the honey in your hive will change depending on what flowers are blooming at that time. There are also different types of honey depending on how it's processed, right? There's raw honey, whipped honey, all of that. I wanted to talk about toxic honey. That's sort of...
Is there something with babies that you shouldn't feed honey to young babies?
We have it in the
babies?
Book. Yeah. We have it in the book. They say not to feed honey to babies under a year old.
Yeah, I never understood why that was. But maybe we'll get back to that.
I don't know the reason. We do have it. It is commonly said, and we did put it in the book, but I'm not sure why.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Did you want to say something?
No, go ahead.
I want to talk about some honey can be toxic.
Oh, really? Okay.
Honey from certain flowers is called mad honey. And it's produced when bees collect the nectar from rhododendrons or azaleas.
Mm-hmm.
I know azaleas are poisonous.
Mm-hmm.
So remember, in Florida, they have a lot of azaleas, and they tell you to keep your dogs away from them.
Okay, I didn't know that they were poisonous azaleas.
And rhododendron, interestingly.
Yeah.
Also mountain laurel. These are very common plants.
Mm-hmm.
So they all contain chemicals that are psychoactive and toxic to humans, but not to bees. They're not going to kill you. The effects are short-lived. But the symptoms, you may feel nauseous, you may vomit, you may sweat, you may feel dizzy.
Maybe that's the reason they don't want you to give it to the babies.
Well, nobody should be using this kind of honey, right?
But
it's used medicinally this kind of mad honey in Turkey at one point. Anyway, I don't know if they still do it. It's used as a treatment for gastrointestinal disorders, which you can understand if it makes you vomit. It seems to be have an effect on the gastrointestinal system. In New Zealand, one of your favorite places, you tell your Australian stories, New Zealand has a toxic honey from a different source. Bees in New Zealand gather honeydew, which is a secretion from vinehopper insects, and these insects feed on a toxic bush called a tutu. And tutin poisoning is also vomiting, delirium, giddiness, stupor, and convulsions. And since 2001, New Zealand beekeepers have been required to closely monitor the area within 3 kilometers of their hives so that the bees don't forage on these tutu bushes.
Yeah, that's something honey. To take into account with when you buy honey. But I guess if you buy commercial honey, it's treated somehow, isn't it? Is it boiled or something? I don't know what they do to it.
They also have poisonous honey in Brazil that the hunters use for tipping their arrows and killing fish.
So that's really poisonous, honey.
Yeah, from the sumac plant.
Yeah, the sumac, right. Yeah, they used to say you can drink sumac tea, but then they said it may have cancer-producing properties.
Not a good idea.
Not a good idea for sumac tea. Okay, so we're sort of down on honey right here and right now because of all
No, but most
possibly,
honey is wonderful.
But most honey is wonderful, and I'm sure if you get honey from a beekeeper, that you know, and he's probably careful checking out what's in the neighborhood that the bees are getting nectar from.
Right.
And the same if you buy a commercial honey. When we travel, we like to buy different honey from different parts of the country because it has different flavors.
It has a lot of antioxidants.
And
the
antioxidants.
Darker the honey, the more antioxidants.
Right, like buckwheat honey.
Buckwheat
I think
honey
is
the darkest.
It's the darkest one.
That's right.
Okay, so we're going to take a break now. And we'll be back with another segment about bees, and we'll just buzz right back. Sorry about that. In a minute. And this is the Heritage Radio Network, and our sponsor is Whole Foods. And we're signing off for a minute, and we'll be right back. So stick around. Okay, this is Bernie Wides, The Naturalist. We're back on the air with Heritage Radio Network, the program The Naturalist. And my special guest today is Carol Butler, who has a brand new book out about bees and why do bees buzz, and terrific, as I mentioned before. So, Carol, you said you wanted to talk some more about honey,
right,
which is a product that we get from the bees.
I just want to end on a positive note about honey, because we were being so negative before. They have found that mild burns healed faster when treated with honey and covered with gauze. There's been some research on that as compared to similar burns that were treated with an antibiotic cream or another type of dressing. Although some of these things are a little bit controversial, but they did have some good results. And they also did a study with, I'm trying to see how many, 105 children with persistent coughs. Children aged 2 to 18 years of age were in the study, and they gave them a dose of buckwheat honey half an hour before they went to bed. And they also gave them honey. Another group got honey-flavored cough medicine. Another group was just left to cough all night. And honey was rated by the parents of the children as having provided the most symptomatic relief of the nighttime coughing and sleep difficulties.
Oh, that's
so
good
that's
to
good
know.
To
yeah,
know.
That's good. Right.
Right.
Okay.
Okay, so then we were going to talk about bee stings, another lovely topic. Have you ever been stung by a bee?
Yes, yes. I was once hiking on a trail, and we didn't know that there was a hive, and I don't know what they were, whether they were yellow jackets or bees, but they really got me. Mm. And I don't know, the only thing I did was put some cold water on it. I didn't have any other remedies to use.
Okay.
Except get out of there fast.
Right. Well, I don't know what stung you. I've never been stung by a bee. People who tend to be allergic have to be very careful, because you can get one bee sting is nothing. It's a very minor amount of toxin. But if you are stung by Africanized bees, which are very aggressive, and where many bees will sting, it can cause anaphylactic shock. And we maybe talk more about killer bees if we have time. I just wanted to say, I don't know what it feels like to be stung by a bee. And so when I was working on the book, I wrote the book with Elizabeth Capaldi Evans, by the way. We need to include her here because she's a beekeeper and biologist and knows an awful lot about bees.
Where is she located?
She teaches at Bucknell University.
Oh, Bucknell. Okay.
So we were trying to describe what it feels like, and I was looking in the literature. One author describes a bee sting as similar to a car door slamming on your fingers. Another one describes it as feeling like touching a hot match.
Mm-hmm. That's more like it, I would say. Yeah.
Okay. And then a stinging bee emits an alarm pheromone that calls for reinforcements, so that there's a potential for more toxins to be injected by the bees that respond to her signal. The bees are not aggressive, and most stings occur near a hive,
right,
because
they're
trying. Otherwise, they're not really interested in stinging you.
Do they lose their stingers?
If they sting another insect, they don't lose their stinger. But if they sting a person, the stinger will stick in the person's skin,
mm-hmm.
and you may even see the venom sacs are still pulsating on the outside of where the stinger went in, and then they'll die,
right?
Because this stinger is the ovipositor, and it breaks off, and then they're vulnerable and they'll die. That's why you see they are attracted to the face and ears. That's the most vulnerable parts, because they cue to the carbon dioxide that we exhale.
Mm-hmm.
And so you'll see beekeepers almost always wearing a hat and veil, even if they don't wear other protective clothing. Some beekeepers who've been stung a lot build up a tolerance and become immune to the venom.
Oh, really? You can do that? Uh-huh.
Now, you're going to like this part. This is how they sting. How does a bee sting?
Yeah.
If you see a bee just flying around, the stinger is not apparent. You don't see this pointed stinger sticking out of its abdomen. But when it wants to, the abdomen is the third section of the body, right?
The back, the rear.
The rear mm-hmm. end. When the bee is alarmed, the sting drops and locks into place like the landing gear on an airplane, right? And muscles in the abdomen thrust the stinger into its target. So I just like that image of it, like the locking into place, like the landing gear.
Mm.
Why do they sting is another question we have. They don't sting because they're angry. They really sting if there's a sign that there's a disturbance or some kind of danger to the stability of the nest.
Mm-hmm. There's a threat to the hive.
To the hive, right.
Right.
Then we could talk about killer bees. These are...
Yes, are they really killer bees?
They really are.
Yeah.
They're Africanized honeybees.
What does that mean, Africanized?
Well, they originated... They're all descendants of 26 Tanzanian queen bees. The Tanzanian bees were accidentally released in 1957 from a breeding program in Brazil, which was attempting to artificially select for bee traits that would produce more honey and
uh-huh.
better pollinators in the tropics. So they imported these 26 bees. And that's one of the reasons they inseminate bees, is they're always trying to breed bees that give out more honey and
sure.
are less aggressive and are hardier for different climates.
Mm-hmm.
So these bees escaped or were accidentally released and then mated with various European bees, various regular honeybees, Apis mellifera. And began spreading around as they made it. Prior to, I'm going ahead of myself here. Prior to there were no bees. I mean, in America, North and South America, there were no honeybees colonization.
Right. They brought them with them.
Right.
That's the one that we use now for pollinization mostly, right?
Right, the honeybees,
The European honeybee.
Right. I hear a telephone.
It's not a bee.
Okay. Africanized bees have established themselves in a wider and wider area of the United States. And at the peak rate of expansion, they spread north at a rate of almost a mile a day, which is pretty incredible. And this is, again, just reproducing and flying around and spreading out. They have been seen as far south as Argentina, to the north as far as Trinidad and the West Indies. They've been found in Mexico, Texas, Arizona, Florida, Southern California. In June, and people keep track of them. If they're like the kind of studies that they were doing in Central Park, if an Africanized bee pops up, this is a big problem.
Mm-hmm.
In June 2005, they found them in southwest Arkansas. 2007, they were reported in the New Orleans area.
Mm.
And they've caused a few deaths. There are some deaths reported in Texas from the from these type of bees.
From the sting of the bees.
From the sting, yeah. They don't manage well in the cold temperatures, so we probably won't get them this far north, but they're really a big danger. I'm writing a book about horses, and in the horse book, I read that in a couple of cases, foals have died.
Baby horses.
Where they were a swarm of Africanized bees attacked them. Because they're so small, they were more vulnerable. Then there are stingless bees, which are not honeybees. Those are meliponid bees, and they have atrophied or vestigial stingers that aren't capable of stinging under any circumstances.
This is just a natural thing that's happening.
Right.
Yeah. Evolutionary.
And most of them are mild-mannered. But the question that's interesting is how do they defend themselves if they can't sting? And some of them bite when they're threatened. They will fight viciously over food. Some of them secrete a caustic saliva that is acidic and makes their bite extremely uncomfortable.
Like ants.
A lot of ants have formic acid. That's right, right, mm-hmm. Exactly. And they will mark potential predators with a chemical secretion that then brings additional bees to react defensively by buzzing and biting and even pulling hair. Sort of interesting. Another species enters the eyes, ears, and nose of the threatening animal or person and then buzzes its wings loudly, which is a pretty effective way to make you run away.
Sure.
Right? I would certainly run away if something got in my ear and buzzed like that.
Okay, so the Africanized bees are a real threat. I mean, if you had them around your house, you'd have to be really careful,
right?
And get rid of them.
Right.
But the bee breeders, have they tried to breed bees for producing honey that don't sting?
Good question.
So I wonder if that, because you said they do insemination of bees. They do that to increase the production of honey.
Right.
Is that right?
To develop different strains.
Different strains.
Right.
Yeah.
I wanted to mention some very interesting behavior on the part of Cyprian honeybees that defend themselves against the local hornets. There are these big oriental hornets. And like all insects, we didn't get to talk about this, but they breathe through spiracles. Those are holes in the exoskeleton.
In the abdomen.
Right.
It's
all around.
It's in the thorax.
So they have multiple holes. They contract their abdominal muscles to exhale, and they relax the muscles to inhale, right?
They don't have lungs like we do,
right?
And they don't have a circulatory system like we have.
Right.
Well, we have these little capillaries that go all over our body, bringing oxygen.
Right.
So they just have these series of tubes, right?
Right.
Just like the butterflies and a lot of other insects.
And they have plates in the exoskeleton that protect the holes that open and close. Uh-huh. This is in the case of the bees. And what they found is that the bees defending themselves against these hornets cluster around the hornet and suffocate it by making it impossible for it to open the spiracles.
Oh, that's terrific strategy.
Right? Yeah. Then there's a Japanese honeybee that guards against their local hornets in a different way. In the Japanese bees, they're all cool weather animals. They're accustomed to a cool climate. And when bees are threatened by a hornet, a huge group of bees, they call it thermoballing. It surrounds the predatory hornet in a cluster, and then they vibrate their muscles, and they heat the hornet up to a temperature that kills it.
Wow.
Which would be over 100 degrees Fahrenheit. So
yeah.
It's a thermal strategy. It's very rare, but it's really pretty interesting.
Well, probably the Japanese, they're pretty good at innovating this stuff. So these are Japanese heating bees.
Right.
You know,
they're actually honeybees.
They're honeybees. Okay, so we're going to stop on that note of this segment of Bee Talk. And if you think you missed some stuff, well, listen to last week's show also. And we'll continue in a minute. This is Heritage Radio Network, The Naturalist, my guest, Carol Butler. And remember, our sponsor is Whole Foods Markets. And we'll be back in a minute with some more information on, we'll give you the rest of the buzz on the bees. Hi, this is Bernie Wides, The Naturalist, back on the air, Heritage Radio Network, and today's topic are bees, specifically honeybees, because that's the ones that we, the valuable ones. The other bees are valuable also. They do a lot of pollination, but they don't produce honey for us. So we were talking about being stung by a bee, which is a pretty painful experience, and some bees are really, the Africanized bees are really dangerous if you're stung by those guys. Because they may have toxins in their sting.
Well, they're so, very aggressive.
They're very aggressive. That's the difference.
Honeybees aren't aggressive.
Yeah. So, Carol, you want to talk a little bit about how to avoid being stung?
I think it's only fair.
It's a good topic since we're talking about bees. How to avoid being stung, besides not having any bees around.
Right. Well, for the most part, you can avoid honeybee nests because they tend. Unless you live in the country, they'll be in managed colonies. So we have a beehive outside the window here. It looks kind of like a file cabinet. So if you see several large white boxes that have look like drawers, those very well might be beehives, and you ought to stay away from them. If a bee is nearby, the best strategy is to just ignore it. They will simply fly by. They're really looking for nectar. You don't interest them at all. It's not like butterflies, right? Butterflies, when we're in the conservatory where Bernie and I work at the American Museum of Natural History, the butterflies are looking to mate, and they are very curious. And so they will sit. They sit on the visitors all the time. They like the perspiration. They'll ingest some of the perspiration, but they're foraging and they're looking for a mate. So they're very curious and very busy. The bees are all business.
Yeah,
they're just looking for nectar, and they really are not interested in anything that's not a flower.
What about if you have perfume on? Do you think that would attract them?
I don't think so.
Uh-huh.
I don't think so. I know that, and they're only interested in a certain type of consistency of the sweetness. We can talk about, I know we studied this in the hummingbird book. If you have a hummingbird feeder, you don't want bees coming to the hummingbird feeder and bothering the hummingbirds to compete for the nectar. You have sugar water, syrup in the feeder. So what they do, this is my colleague George West, who knows all about hummingbirds, with whom I wrote the hummingbird book. They take a coffee can and they put a sugar solution that is more interesting to the bees, whether it's sweeter or less sweet. I think it's more sweet. Mm-hmm. It's a more denser consistency.
Yeah.
And they stick some branches in it into the coffee can so that the bees have something to hold on to. And the bees will go to the coffee can with the sticks, and the hummingbirds will go to the hummingbird feeder because the consistency is different. So they're really very picky about where they go.
Yeah, and by the way, in a couple of weeks, we'll have a whole show on hummingbirds when Carol's next book comes out, the hummingbird book.
Right.
But we'll save that for another time.
Okay, so don't wave your arms around. If a bee comes near you, just ignore it. And also not to wear strong perfume or cologne, and to wear light-colored clothing, just so you don't confuse them or make them interested in investigating you. The picnic tables are often the places where people encounter what they think are bees, but usually the stinging insects that visit the picnic tables are wasps.
The yellow jackets.
Yellow jackets,
yeah,
right.
They are wasps.
Bees are strict vegetarians, so they wouldn't be interested. There'd be nothing for them to eat at most picnic tables. They're not interested in soda pop and things like cans, the sweet, sticky.
Sugary solutions.
Right, unless it's just the right type of consistency.
Yeah.
They wouldn't come to a soda can where a wasp will do that.
Yeah, a wasp will come to anything.
Right. And then what do you do if you get a bee sting? What are their natural remedies? Putting a poultice of water and baking soda or even meat tenderizer may alleviate the itch of a bee sting.
Mm.
People also suggest putting a slice of onion or potato on the site of the sting, which is interesting. Or washing the area with cider vinegar.
I think maybe just a cold liquid helps. That's
right.
We're going to get recipes now for poultices for bee sting.
Right.
So I'll have to talk Erica about that.
Right.
My daughter Erica, you know, is Chef Erica, and she has a program on Tuesdays. And I'm going to have to get together and talk about some.
Get her up to speed on the bees.
Well,
she probably knows all about them already because she wants to do
a hive.
So we could talk a little bit more since we started talking about how they breathe. We said how they breathe, that they bring the air in through the spiracles on the side of the body. And then there's a network of tubes called trachea that weave their way around the organs and through the tissues. And that allows the air to ooze through the bee's body.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how they breathe. That's how the larvae and inactive insects breathe that way, just taking in oxygen, expelling carbon dioxide through this system. When a bee flies, it needs more oxygen. And it's so that its flight muscles move the air through the body by expanding air sacs that are part of the respiratory system, and it draws air in more forcefully.
Something like lungs, you think, those air sacs?
Well, they're air sacs, not lungs.
They're
just bringing the air in rather than dispersing it. The lungs disperse it. And then the spiracles contract and compress the air sacs, forcing the air deeper into the body so that more oxygen reaches the cells. And then the spiracles open and carbon dioxide is expelled. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
So, does a bee have a heart?
Yes, I was going to ask you that as the next question.
Right. Now, you know about butterfly hearts, right?
Yes. Right.
What do you know about butterfly hearts? I know you know this because we talk about it in the conservatory.
Well, they're not like our heart.
Right.
Butterfly hearts. They are just they're a pump.
Right.
But they don't have all these chambers like we have.
Right. It's really like an open. It's a tube.
It's a tube that they squeeze the tube with. How do they do that? With muscle pressure?
Yeah. Yeah.
So similar to the bees.
That's right.
Right.
So the bees, the same thing. They have an open circulatory system.
Right.
They don't have veins or arteries. And the body fluid, the hemolymph, washes directly around the tissues and organs. Mm-hmm. And but they have the same kind of thing, a pulsating muscular tube along the back,
yep,
pumps the hemolymph from the abdomen to the thorax and then to the head, squeezing the hemolymph along. Hemolymph along. That's hard to say. Hemolymph along.
Does the hemolymph carry the oxygen?
Yes.
Okay, yeah. So the sphericals, which it's an open system,
right,
to take the air in.
Right.
So does the oxygen get absorbed by the hemolymph? Probably, because it's called hemolymph. They must have some similar to red blood cells. I don't know.
Right. And it also it takes the wastes out also.
Okay,
it flushes the body.
Right.
And they also have little called simple hearts or ostia, which butterflies don't have. These are additional pulsating organs. Mm. This is very interesting. Located at, it's because, I don't know, I was going to say, because butterflies don't really do much.
Yeah,
right?
Bees are very active.
Bees are very active.
And they move their wings very rapidly because you can see them standing in place like a helicopter.
Right, and they work. They're working. They're feeding the larvae thousand times
constantly
a day
on a move
and foraging.
And feeding it,
so they need more. The butterflies sit around, or they forage, or they mate, and they fly, but they do a lot of just sitting around, which I think is
they don't have anybody to take care of except themselves.
That's right.
Their whole role as adults is to reproduce.
And if you look in a beehive, which I have done, everything is pulsating and buzzing. It's very busy. Everybody's very busy. So they have simple hearts. They have additional hearts at other points in the body that boosts the fluid circulation.
Mm-hmm.
And as the muscles relax, the fluid circulates back into the dorsal vessel along the back of the body, moving more or less quickly depending on the insect's activity level. Hemolymph does not carry oxygen.
Okay,
I was wrong. So that it's really kind of an inefficient system, but it's adequate enough to distribute the nutrients to the cells.
Right. So you don't see any huge giant insects, really. Insects are small. I think that's part of the problem, that they don't have a circulatory system like we do. So I don't know any giant insects really bigger than.
There were some pretty big.
Yeah,
go up on the entomology floor in the museum. They have some pretty big insects up there.
Well,
but they may have a different structure.
Yeah, I think that they're limited because of their air circulation system.
I think that, we could talk about, I don't know how many more minutes, a couple more minutes.
Mm-hmm.
Do bees bleed? How about that?
Yes, their blood. They have this hemolymph.
Right. If you may have heard that if you pull the leg off an insect, it will bleed to death because it lacks a clotting component in its blood.
Mm.
Well, I don't know about that. I know it's not true with butterflies because we see butterflies who are missing a leg sometimes, and if they're okay, and it's not true with bees, since the hemolymph does clot. To prevent large amounts of fluid loss after an injury. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
and they tested the fluid, and they found that it clots in relatively short order.
Mm-hmm. So it has a clotting factor. Like
it has
we
a clotting
have,
factor. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that's good. Okay.
They're like white blood cells. The same kind of component that defends them also against infection and gathers to close openings that penetrate the exoskeleton.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So we're going to end this segment. And my guest is Carol Butler, and we're talking about bees. And if you have any questions at all about bees or all that, you can leave a comment on our site, and we'll try to get back to you. Or if you want more information, you can call in. And remember that Carol has this new book that's just out, Why Do Bees Buzz?
Right.
And we answered that question in the first part, why do they buzz? They buzz because their wings vibrate and they buzz.
And we have a lot more questions in the book that we didn't get to answer.
Yeah. something like mosquitoes. The noise the mosquitoes make also is the vibrating of the wings.
Right.
And with mosquitoes, it's a little more interesting also, but we won't talk about mosquitoes today.
Right.
Okay, so there are some other questions about bees and honey and all that. And
I'm interested in writing a book about mosquitoes if anybody wants to publish it.
Okay, so Carol's looking for somebody to get along.
Publish
it. Okay.
I have a proposal for a book about mosquitoes because they are fascinating, as you say. Very, very interesting.
Yeah.
And bed bugs also.
Oh, bed bugs, which are making a comeback.
We could go on and on.
Right. Okay, and cockroaches. You mentioned cockroaches.
Right. I don't want to write a book about cockroaches.
No, I don't think it would be a big seller, to tell you the truth.
I'm interested in bed bugs.
Especially in New York City.
Right.
Okay. So we are off the air now.
Thank you very much for having me.
Yes,
this was
Carol
lovely.
Carol was our guest today, and we had a good time together, as we usually do.
As always.
And you look forward to future episodes coming up. Michael Hamburg, who's an astronomer, is on jury duty. As soon as he gets finished with that, we'll have him on. And then we'll talk about my trip to Puerto Rico.
Very good. Looking forward to it.
Me